When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Before the Supreme Court, Trump v. Anderson. This is the story of Colorado, the Colorado Supreme Court deciding in the middle of December last year, citing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that Mr. Trump is ineligible to appear on the ballot in the Republican primary, March 5th in Colorado, because, and therein lies the debate, the word insurrection, the word office and officer, the concept of self-executing, all this was presented to the court by two distinguished representatives of both sides. And the court, in cue and answer, educated me a deal about how the court moves in front of the public as opposed to what we get from decisions. The word which came up several times was in terms of precedentially, that is, the court makes a profound distinction between decisions based on precedent, prior precedent, and decisions that are fresh. And challenging precedent is a big watchword. However, there was much more to the argument, and I need help. So I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, my colleague and friend, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. Professor, a very good evening to you. I'm going to divide what I heard yesterday into two parts. The first one was about the term, the concept of self-executing. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, is it self-executing? The second was the distinction made between two words that look a lot alike. One is office, the other is officer. Let's begin with self-executing. Why was this such a debate, especially between the counsel for the Trump side, saying that Colorado was out of bounds, and the counsel for the Colorado side was, I'd have to say, defensive about self-executing? Good evening to you, Professor.
Yeah, hi. Well, the problem about self-executing is a very old one in the law, and it comes up in lots of contexts. Indeed, in connection with takings laws right before the Supreme Court today. The way it starts is with Section Amendment 14. I'm going to read it. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Okay, now you look at that. And then the question is, after you pass this 14th Amendment, must Congress decide to pass some statute which takes all slaves who were non-persons before this were done in order to make them citizens? And the word self-executing is designed to say, no, the Constitution, in fact, makes them into citizens, and no legislation whatsoever is required. Indeed, it would be absurd to read it the other way around, because here what you do is you have this bold declaration, and then Congress is in enemy hands, as it were, and what those characters decide to do is not to enact this. So it's self-executing, meaning once the Constitution is passed, everything is done by. Now, there's another question about what self-executing is, which is what the Constitution does. It gives you a specific right as a person against a specific government, the United States. And so there is a clause which says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And the government decides to take your property. And they don't pass a statute except to say, you are not allowed to sue to recover your property. And people are going to come forward and say, wait, this is absurd. You got an explicit constitutional protection, and then Congress passes an absolute bar against this or refuses to act. That can't be right. So the claim was made that this has to be a self-executing proposition so as to allow people whose property taken to have some remedy. What happened is this issue never hit the road in quite the way you might expect, because in the next breath, by 1887, there was a general bill called the Tucker Act. And what that provided is a general authorization for any individual to sue the United States for taking of their property in the court of claims. Well, at this point, the issue is gone because they didn't want to force it to that. Under the Fourth Amendment, there's still a question under the so-called Bivens Doctrine whether if somebody seizes your property in an unreasonable search and seizure, do you have a remedy that's self-executing? And the answer there seems to be yes. Well, in DeVilliers, this weird case, what happened was the state of Texas took some property by inverse condemnation. What that means is they flooded somebody else's land without getting a permit to do so. And they're saying, even though you didn't get the permit, this inverse condemnation, we have to have a remedy and have it in state court. And it turns out that the state has a statute which, in fact, allows you to bring them. So the state government goes into federal court. And there, the Tucker Act won't help because it only deals with claims against the federal government. And the state act won't help because it only deals with claims in state court. So poor Mr. DeVille is saying, you brought me here. This has to be self-executing in this narrow set of cases so that I can sue. And Texas cannot defeat me by a kind of a jurisdictional maneuver by going into federal court. And that's a tough case. Now, you get to this case, what they're saying is, oh, here we have this. We have a remedy provision which talks about how the two houses of Congress could waive the disability. But no, we've got the president. That doesn't work because he gets chosen through the Electoral College, and they have no chance to stop him. So what we have to do is treat this as self-executing, meaning now that any state at any time, for any reason, can decide to bring an action to stop him from holding office. And if you look at the Colorado case, it's really much more insidious than one might think. The way the Secretary of State decided all this, and she said, look, I mean, I have the power to control elections in the state of Colorado, including those for the presidential office. We had a case once, which was clearly right, which said that we could keep off the ballot the president, somebody who was 32 years of age, given the fact that the Constitution requires that to be 35 years of age. So we could keep them off here. Now, you think about this for a second. Suppose she decided she wanted to keep him off for bad character. And she says, under Colorado law, bad character is a prerequisite for good character, is a prerequisite for getting on the ballot. Well, at this point, oh my God, your head goes up, because it's very clear under the term limits case that the only requirements that you have for precedent are those which are in fact set out in the clause of, she said, you have to be a citizen of the United States and 35 years of age. And now she's saying she can unilaterally change that in the Colorado election law without Section 3. Well, if you can do that, the whole game is over. And in fact, nobody could add qualification. You can say you can only run for president if you disclose your tax returns or something of that sort. And so she's clearly wrong in asserting this. And what the Supreme Court was very intent about was saying, we cannot have a situation where this whole thing gets screwed up because individual states using their own standards and their own interpretation, their own definitions of insurrection, will decide to keep somebody off a national election.
Professor, I want to introduce the concept I think I also heard about this term self-executing. They pointed to the caveat in the amendment that Congress, by a vote of two-thirds, can remove this declaration of being an insurrectionist. Right. The presumption was that mitigates this claim that it's self-executing because you need, if the Congress can remove it, therefore it is with the blessing of the Congress that it was first inserted, not self-executed. Do I hear that correctly?
You hear it correctly. In the way in which these guys, when they started to look at this, they said, if that's the way in which it's done, it doesn't apply to the president at all. So the way in which they then did this, and it's a very good answer, is they said a necessary condition for bringing anything is that Congress authorized the states to do it.
Right.
Because only then will you have some kind of uniformity with the way in which this thing is going to be undertaken. In this particular case, Congress has authorized absolutely nothing, so no state person can go. That is the argument which will be the winning argument in this particular case, because it's so compelling and so sensible but it doesn't answer all the questions.
Let's move to the other detail that I heard from the bench. Forgive me for interrupting, but the other one was even more muddy for my brain. I didn't have the benefit of being your student in law school. It's the distinction made, I think it's the word distinction, the difference, the distinction between the word office and officer. And you have explicated this before, but that was especially an interest from the bench yesterday, whether or not the President of the United States is an officer of the United States.
Look, the way in which this thing is so difficult is if you have that somebody holds an office, and he does hold the office of President of the United States, it's very difficult to say that you can't put the R on that to make him an officer of the United States. The technical difficulty with this arises from the simple fact that the way in which this entire constitutional stuff is structured, there is a specific definition of officer in Article 2 of the Constitution in the Appointments Clause. And so what it says is, when you start looking at this, he says the president shall appoint all other officers, right, of the United States, right, whose appointments are not hereby otherwise provided for. So the president can appoint all officers, right, except the ones listed above, but then he can't be an officer. And so the argument first made by Judge Mukasey, which I think is correct, is the whole word officer in the Appointments Clause in Section 2 of the Constitution refers only to appointed officials. It doesn't appoint to elective officials. And then this is strengthened if you look at the first words of Section 3, which says any congressman, any senator, or any elector for the president or the vice president. Well, the president's not on that list, but the electors are. Why is that? Because these are all chosen at the state level. And in 1868, they were worried that a corrupt Congress or a corrupt state legislator could put on there an insurrectionist, i.e. somebody who fought in the Civil War. If you could keep these guys off of these committees, then the Electoral College could function as usual, and you don't have to have any constraint on the president. So there's a deliberate reason why they left his name off, and if you know the reason why they left his name off, you don't want to say that any person is going to cover the president when he should have been done explicitly. The president is such a big enchilada in these particular games, you don't want to smuggle him into the word he. And that is also a correct argument. The problem about that is, again, the natural language argument that goes in the opposite direction, which I think is wrong. Generally speaking, a document can define its own terms in whatever way it sees fit. And if you understand what its stipulated definition is, you follow it. That happens all the time in patent cases. But I don't think they're going to want to go there, because the other argument is that nobody has to fight with anything. And the difficulty with the argument is, suppose Congress does authorize it, and it uses a very broad definition of what counts as an insurrection. The authorization will not solve that problem, because it says you can only enforce it with appropriate legislation. And the Supreme Court has held in other cases that you cannot expand the scope of a constitutional guarantee of disability by authorizing that. The word appropriate means it has to be strictly instrumental. It has to be an efficient way to get at insurrection, what kind of trial you use, for example. But it can't be to say what Colorado said, that an insurrection consists of any two people who use force or threaten force in order to change the outcome of an election. That's just obstruction of voting.
Beg pardon, Professor. We need to move to another topic. So your measure of how the court will decide this promptly, 7-2, 6-3, 9-0?
It'll be 9-0 on the Congress must act first. And I don't even know if they will reach the other questions. They may decide just to be quiet about it, because this one is so dispositive, and they all agree, and I don't think they want to undercut the legitimacy of the election by speculating on things they don't have to do.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.